At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you ever doubted this was a show about the global economy, well, doubt no more. Today we've got shoppers in Brooklyn searching for a supermarket, migrant workers in China moving back home, and diaper buyers everywhere connected to one factory in Japan. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, October 1st. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, who's in Cleveland for a live Marketplace election special at WCPN. Thanks for joining us. Now, before we go all global on you, as promised, let's start with the presidential campaigns. They're in full gear now, and it's hard to turn on the TV or radio without hearing an ad for or against one of the candidates. Even ads for products are now getting into the game. Tostitos, 7-Eleven, Boston Market, they're all using the election to sell you stuff. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look at why ads are mixing products with politics.
For the next 5 weeks, it's all about politics. Apparently, even if you're trying to sell tortilla chips.
But don't forget, Senator, 3 years ago, your policy was completely different.
Is that a bag of Tostitos?
It is. The sober debate erupts into dance, and the audience has to choose between cheese dip and salsa. Andrew Frank is with Gartner Research. He says in ads like these, products
try to ride the coattails of the focus of attention
and hopefully get customers to ride those coattails to new places, like social media.
You'll see a lot of attempts by brands to co-opt attention in the social channel.
Take Boston Market. If customers vote online in the race of chicken versus turkey, they get a free entree. There's 7-Eleven's 7-Election, where you vote by choosing a red or blue coffee cup and then check the results out on their website. Marissa Gluck is with Radar Research. She says political beliefs are emotional and personal, strong parts of our identity. Brands want to become part of the way we express that.
If you can display your political affiliation through that corporation, it's actually pretty smart.
And tying products to politicians is not much of a stretch, says Larry Sabato. He directs the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia.
A long time ago, Adlai Stevenson objected to the selling of candidates as soap powder and cereal. So I suppose it's inevitable that cereal companies and soap powder companies will use the elections for their own purposes.
Now you just have to decide. Are you a cheese dip person or a salsa person? No waffling. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Here's something shoppers will be seeing more of in stores this holiday season: workers. Macy's said today it will hire around 80,000 seasonal workers to staff its stores and call centers. That's up about 2.5% from last year. Kohl's, Toys R Us, and Walmart are also looking for more temporary help. in this economy, even temp jobs are good news, right? But could they turn into something more? Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Macy's expects shoppers to buy more this holiday season, so it's bringing in more people to stock shelves, answer phones, and ring up sales. Some of those people could end up with permanent jobs. Spokesman Jim Slezewski says seasonal work can be a tryout.
Very often when full-time or year-round positions become available, they're the first ones we turn to.
That's what happened at Target last year. The retailer says 30% of its seasonal staff stuck around after the holidays. At Toys R Us, 15% landed long-term jobs. But those were the lucky ones.
Numbers from the Labor Department suggest that most of the jobs disappear after the season is over.
That's John Challenger with job placement firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas. He says with the economy still growing so slowly, demand isn't strong enough for a big jump in hiring. Target, for instance, is adding fewer temporary workers than last year. Walmart plans to give more hours to existing employees. Challenger says the tough economy is also changing who's applying for holiday work.
It's no longer just a college student coming home. There are people who need a second job. We're seeing older people who come back into the workforce.
Macy's won't comment on how much those people can expect to earn. Challenger says seasonal retail work tends to pay near minimum wage and no benefits. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A mostly upbeat start to the week on Wall Street. Details when we do the numbers. Okay, we go from department stores to supermarkets. You've heard that term food desert, right? Well, we're usually talking about poor urban neighborhoods that lack a decent grocery store. Well, Windsor Terrace in Brooklyn is hardly poor, but it recently lost its only supermarket. Sally Herships reports on why residents in this mostly middle-class New York neighborhood are missing a grocery store.
Connie Thompson's apartment in Brooklyn looks just like a grandmother's. It's got squishy chairs and sofas, wall-to-wall carpeting, and it's quiet. Thompson is 67, and she is a grandmother of five. Normally, she likes to cook for her family, but lately, she's been forced to make some changes.
I don't know if I like them. I bought the flake potatoes, so I don't have to go out and buy, you know, regular potatoes.
For the past 30 years, Thompson shopped at her local grocery, a Key Food, just a couple blocks away. But in June, it closed. Like many of her neighbors, Thompson doesn't have a car, and the only other supermarkets here are too far for her to carry potatoes on foot, at least a mile away.
I have emphysema, and I have asthma. So for me to walk up the hill, it's a hardship for me. And then you have to figure, you know, if I don't do that, I have to take the bus. So now it's costing me money.
The Key Food closed when its longtime owner retired and moved to Florida, but not before he leased the space to a Walgreens. According to a local councilman, Walgreens was the highest bidder, and it beat out grocery stores for the space. It's a big corner location with a parking lot, a rarity in this part of Brooklyn.
Well, when you're looking for sites, there's a couple of very highly rated attributes.
John Stanton teaches food marketing at St. Joseph's University.
One is being on a corner, and the second is having a big parking lot.
He says pharmacy chains like Walgreens are eating into the turf that used to belong only to grocery stores. If you look at the shelves in your local national pharmacy chain, you'll probably notice they're selling more food. In the process, they're muscling small grocers out.
There's no longer supermarkets that everybody likes a little. There are only supermarkets that somebody likes a lot.
Think specialty stores like Whole Foods or your local Italian market. Of course, the margins on groceries are much lower than on health and beauty aids, but pharmacy chains like Walgreens stock them because they want to lure you in. We shop for food more often than soap or shampoo. For now, Windsor Terrace remains without a grocery store, at least until Walgreens opens next year, and maybe beyond. The company says it's working with a grocer, but its plans aren't yet clear. John Stanton says there may be hope for the neighborhood.
If it's attractive to Walgreens, it's probably going to be attractive to other people.
Good news for the future, but for now, it's still a trek to the grocery store. In Brooklyn, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The presidential race enters the home stretch this month. On Wednesday, we get the first of three debates between President Obama and Mitt Romney, and it'll focus largely on the economy. Both candidates have been trying to paint the other guy as the enemy of the middle class. But commentator Michael Casey says both men are pointing fingers in the wrong direction.
Who lost the middle class? That's the question confronting President Obama and Mitt Romney as they march toward voting day. Their answers are predictable. Romney blames regulations and big government. Obama points to policies favoring rich guys like Romney. Sadly for the embattled American middle class, both viewpoints miss the mark. The great stagnation in median income since the early 1990s stems from a failure to calibrate domestic policy to the demands of a rapidly changing world economy. Whether Democrats tax too much or Republicans too little is irrelevant against the sweeping economic disruptions caused by two decades of unprecedented globalization. Global money flows have grown exponentially as restrictions on trade and investment have eased. But the exchange rates used to price these money flows have become distorted. China's manipulation of its currency has reduced the price of its exports in dollar terms. Meanwhile, the dollar's role as the world's reserve currency has given America access to a colossal amount of cheap credit. This combination generates a multi-trillion dollar excess of savings in China and a dangerous dependence on debt-financed consumer spending in the United States. The result? An evisceration of America's competitiveness. At the same time, Wall Street's risk-taking ethos has infected the entire global financial sector. It's permitted bankers to draw exorbitant paychecks while the risk of financial crises has risen. As we've seen, the burden of paying for those meltdowns has shifted to middle-class taxpayers. Since we cannot wind back the clock on globalization, we must match it with globalized policymaking, where a degree of sovereignty is sacrificed in return for economic stability and a more evenly balanced global playing field. It's the only way to restore the American middle class. Just don't count on either presidential candidate to make the case.
Commentator Michael Casey is author of The Unfair Trade: How Our Broken Global Financial System Destroys the Middle Class. Coming up, in China, the workers used to move where the factories were. Now the factories come to them.
80% of the workers here, their hometown is somewhere else, so they prefer to go back.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a mixed start to the new month and the new quarter. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 0.5% or 77 points to close at 13,515. The NASDAQ dipped just under 0.1% or 2 points to end at 3,113. And the S&P 500 added 0.25%, 3 points to finish at 1,444. A positive manufacturing report for September, the first one since May, gave financial firms a boost. Goldman Sachs advanced 2.75%. Bank of America deposited 1.5%. We told you Macy's was expecting a stronger holiday season. That elevated its shares 2.5%. Tokyo's Nikkei index fell 0.8% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. It's the United Nations International Day of Nonviolence. Who's sporting new wheels? Automakers are scheduled to release U.S. sales for September. And when I woke up this morning, it was already October. You may have experienced something similar. But here's something to look forward to. October is American Cheese Month. It can be celebrated wherever there is cheese. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. Here's one of those global economy ripple effect stories. Over the weekend, there was an explosion at a Japanese chemical plant, a plant that makes the chemicals for disposable diapers, the chemicals that make those diapers more absorbent, in other words, that make them work. Is a global diaper deficit next? Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Imagine a world without enough diapers. Now, I'm not going to paint this picture for you. My editor begged me not to give you a detailed description, but you pretty much got it, right? Luckily, that is not where we're headed.
Do moms and dads need to run out and stockpile diapers right now?
Not as I understand it.
Erin Lash is an analyst at Morningstar. She covers Procter & Gamble, which makes Pampers and Loves.
A lot of these companies source chemicals and inputs from a number of different suppliers and aren't dependent on one supplier for all the inputs that are needed.
In a statement, P&G says it doesn't expect any significant impact on its business. In other words, babies won't be left high and dry. Just dry, at least for now. Pricey Hanna is managing partner at Price Hanna Consultants, which works in the hygiene absorbent products area.
So you know a lot about disposable diapers.
That's my business.
The factory in Japan makes about a fifth of the world's super absorbent polymer that keeps diapers from leaking. If it's unable to open soon, prices could go up for the companies that make disposable diapers and for parents who buy them. Hanna says some diaper makers could also be forced to substitute other less absorbent absorbents, which is not really the direction the market wants to go.
Diapers, of course, the primary purpose is to absorb.
But even then,
babies' bottoms are going to stay covered.
Babies' bottoms will absolutely stay covered.
Crisis averted. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
It's been 1 year this month since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Last year during the civil war, their oil production came to a halt. But as Marketplace's David Gura reports, Libya's main business is back in business.
Libya isn't the world's biggest oil producer, but Paul Sullivan, a professor at Georgetown, says it's got a lot of the good stuff, light sweet crude.
It's a lot less expensive to refine a light sweet crude into gasoline and diesel fuel than the heavier crudes.
Since the 60s, Libya has exported most of that oil to Europe. Italy is one of the country's biggest customers. But during the Civil War, many analysts wondered what would happen to Libya's energy sector. Robin Mills is an oil and gas consultant based in Dubai.
I think a lot of people expected that the revolution and the war would really damage the oil production.
But they didn't seem to. Libya is producing about 1.6 million barrels a day, just shy of what it was before the fighting began. Paul Sullivan at Georgetown says all the combatants understood the importance of oil to Libya.
It's not a diversified economy, and clearly both sides in the battle were probably thinking about what's going to happen afterward. We really don't want to ruin everything.
Today, many foreign-owned oil companies are returning to Libya. Sarah Emerson runs Energy Security Analysis.
You know, it's not like some of the other, like the Persian Gulf countries, where there isn't a lot of foreign investment already. It was there, and it appears to be coming back.
Even though the government said it doesn't intend to issue new contracts for a year or two, still, Libya has what the oil industry calls significant downside risks. Case in point, the attack that killed U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens last month. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The swing states are awash in money this campaign season, and if you live in one of them, you see it everywhere, in the blizzard of ads every time you watch TV, in the dozens of campaign offices, the phone banks, the canvassers at your door. So what's it like living in campaign land? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer visited the state of Virginia to find out.
The first thing you notice when you descend into campaign land is you keep tripping over the presidential nominees or their running mates or families. They're all swarming the state. Right now, I'm stuck in traffic. It's not rush hour. It's a Secret Service slowdown.
Hi, good morning. How are you today?
President Obama is holding a rally in a baseball stadium in Woodbridge, Virginia. A long line of people snakes toward the entrance. Among them, graphic designer Lee Duvall Parks. She's wearing a navy blue Obama T-shirt and button. In fact, she's worn an Obama T-shirt almost every day for a year.
I have one that says B-O-O-8, Barack and Roll. I have another one that just says Making History Obama with his picture on it.
At this point, Deval Parks has to move on, and so do I. It's time to visit some Romney-held territory in campaign land. I pull up to a temporary Romney campaign office in an upscale strip mall. Here I meet Dara Fox.
I'm a walking billboard.
Her navy blue T-shirt says Mitt Romney for president. She's worn Romney paraphernalia every day for about 3 months. She says she's always on.
Like, I went into T-Mobile the other day, and the guy said, oh, why are you supporting Romney? And I mentioned Romney's five-point plan.
Yep, here in campaign land, your neighbors have memorized their guy's policy points. But now it's the end of the day, time for a cold one, and Mackey's Pub. But no escape here. Cable news is on one of the TVs above the bar. Political ads march across the screen. All told, the campaigns and outside groups have spent at least $44 million on TV commercials here. Keith Lucas is sitting at the bar. He says some of his friends are fed up and voting for a third-party candidate.
Because they don't like either one of them now, because the ads have turned them off that bad.
Lucas says he wishes it could all be over tomorrow. Living in campaign land is getting really old. In Manassas, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
You probably read about that riot that broke out at a Foxconn factory in China last week. Big news, partly because Foxconn makes the iPad. But what much of the coverage missed was where that riot happened. It was in a city called Taiyuan in northern China, far away from China's coast, where most of our Chinese imports used to be made. For the last two decades, hundreds of millions of farmers migrated to the coast to work at these big factories. But now they're moving back home, and companies like Foxconn are following them. Today, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz begins a series about the end of China's great migration. Today, he looks at the city of Dongguan, at one point one of the most popular destinations for Chinese migrant workers.
China's great migration started here. Farmers boarding crowded trains in Sichuan, Henan, Hubei, poor provinces in China's interior. A day or two later, they arrived here along the Pearl River Delta just north of Hong Kong and became factory workers. Nearly a quarter of a billion people made this journey over and over for the past two decades, the largest human migration the planet has known, fueled by our desire to buy things and by the Chinese hunger to make a better life for their families.
It was almost scary to walk into a factory because, seriously, you would have hundreds of people lined up, like in a big circle around the front of the gate, pushing to get forward to read the sign about what worker they were wanted to hire that day.
Ben Schwal's eyes light up when he remembers what the factory town of Dongguan was like in the 1990s.
And you had to kind of push your way through to get in, and the guard would be yelling and barking at people. And you see the movies where the people trying to, you know, leave the city before the invading army comes. It was like that, but they weren't trying to leave. They were trying to get in.
Schwal's president of System Technology Group. For 15 years, he's helped foreign companies make their products in Dongguan. He remembers a time when he'd bring businessmen in for a factory visit, and each of them was assigned a personal tea pourer. Whenever they'd take a sip, the cup was refilled. These days, a teacup in Dongguan no longer runneth over.
Now, visually you can see it, because you don't have people standing outside the gates, but just drive down the street and every doorway you pass will have a big red sign. Always the signs for seeking workers will be red color. You just look and you see how much red is on the street, and you have a good gauge of the situation.
The street outside Paul Miao's factory is nothing but red, a desperate search for workers. Inside, those he can keep on the assembly line cut and stitch leather. Miao's company makes handbags for Coach, Armani, Fossil, and other luxury brands. He says his clients have downsized their orders because his company can no longer meet the demand.
We have a total of 6-7 production lines here. Each one, ideally, we should have at least 300 people. But we have a few production lines that we have only 150-some, 200-some.
He He's operating with a 20% worker shortage, and by the looks of his recruitment efforts, he says it's going to get worse.
We can have 5-10 people come, and then half of them will not, you know, want to work here. They can come and they take a look at the factory and they wouldn't stay.
Miao says if they don't like what they see, they can just move to the next factory with a red banner in front of it. So Miao's factory has been late on orders this year for major brands, forcing him to airmail some of them at the last minute. When that happens, he makes no profit. Overall revenue this year is down 20%. Want to know how this labor shortage is impacting you? Take a look inside that wallet you bought.
When times were good, the brand would put leather for the, you know, credit card slots, the inside, right? But nowadays, they use vinyls. You pay the same money, but you're getting a lesser product.
At another Dongguan factory, a skeleton shift of workers fastened soles to leather shoes. 10 years ago, more shoes were manufactured in Dongguan than anywhere on Earth. Not anymore. The labor-intensive process of shoemaking has moved to places like Vietnam and Indonesia. That's where Iris Cho, CEO of Emperor Footwear, has moved her shoe factories. Like many factory owners in Dongguan, she turned her Chinese factory into an R&D center after she lost a third of her workforce earlier this year.
It's very frustrating to open, to continue the production in here because the mentality of Chinese, they tend to want to open up their own business in the future. Or even in Dongguan, like 80% of the workers here, they don't live here. Their hometown is somewhere else. So they prefer to go back.
That's the goal of factory worker Xu Dohua, who's made handbags at Paul Miao's factory for 15 years. She plans to move back to her hometown in Sichuan Province next year.
Everybody's hometown is developed now. Mine too. Now there are a lot of factories near my hometown making products like alcohol and even handbags.
For her boss, Paul Miao, that's another worker gone. He may be packing up soon, too. His company has started a factory in an undeveloped part of the Philippines. Very rural, he tells me. He says it reminds him of Dongguan when he first arrived here 20 years ago, before the factories, before trainloads of workers arrived, before China became the economic powerhouse it is today. In Dongguan, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And if you want to peek inside that factory where they make those luxury handbags, check out Rob's slideshow at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, IKEA says it regrets the decision to airbrush women out of its Saudi Arabian catalogs. The images included one of a mom in her PJs standing at the bathroom sink with her young son. The Swedish chain now says excluding women from the catalog clashes with IKEA's values, not to mention its customer base. Reportedly, about 70% of IKEA shoppers are female. And that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Liza Madry, and Jolie Padokas. I'm Sarah Gardner. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.